DNB Tech Minute gives you the day's top tech headlines, from the big names in Silicon Valley to the halls of power. If it's making news in tech, we've got it. Check out DNB Tech Minute in the Tech News Briefing feed from The Wall Street Journal.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Georgians go to the polls Tuesday in two U.S. Senate runoffs as President Trump keeps trying to overturn Georgia's presidential outcome. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with The Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. It's January 5 and the nation's eyes are on Georgia, where voters are going to the polls for these two Senate runoffs. Two Republican incumbents, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, facing off against two Democratic challengers, John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. A lot of early voting, about 3 million ballots have been cast so far, and both races, by all appearances, are looking tight. At the Real Clear Politics polling averages, the Democratic candidates are both up by 0.5 percentage point, but there's not been a whole lot of polling over the holidays. So, Kim, where is your read on where things stand in Georgia?
So my read is that you are getting turnout that is more than is traditional in a midterm election. So by comparison to the 2018 midterms, turnout that is still nonetheless below what you were seeing in the presidential election. And it's still unclear to people exactly what that means and who that favors. One thing that does seem pretty clear from talking to Republicans is that, you know, Democrats have outpaced them in early voting. They are going to need a big day today in in-person voting on the GOP side to offset that or potentially win these. And so that's what people will be looking at. And that's why you've seen, we haven't had a lot of polling going on down there. What polling we do, the averages, for instance, Real Clear Politics has things very tight. But you also have the betting odds markets, and those have often been better predictors, also showing a very tight race.
But it is hard to know, particularly since we're still operating under these pandemic emergency voting rules. As just a reminder to people, the reason for these elections is that in Georgia, under Georgia law, a candidate in November has to get above 50% to win outright. Otherwise, they face a runoff. And David Perdue was just shy of that in November. He came in with 49.7%. And one thing that's notable there is that the Libertarian candidate in that race had 2.3%. So what Perdue needs to do is just improve slightly over what he did a couple months ago. And the story for Kelly Loeffler is a little bit less clear, because that was a special election with an open primary, two Republican candidates splitting the vote. So in November, Loeffler, the incumbent, got about 26% of the vote. The other Republican, Doug Collins, got 20%. And then Bill, the Democratic challenger, Raphael Warnock, got 33%. So Loeffler needs to consolidate Republicans. But the picture in that race, at least to me, is a little bit more muddy.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, it's very interesting. There's so many wild cards, because what's interesting to me first is that both the Democrats fell far short of Mr. Biden's total. John Ossoff was 100,000 votes short of Joe Biden in the election. And I think Raphael Warnock was 800,000, 850,000 or so. Now, you add to that that Stacey Abrams and other groups have been registering voters, and a lot of the new registered voters are African American, and they lean to Democrats. So with margins between 1% and 2% in the polls, you know, the last couple of weeks, it's going to be whoever gets those voters out. But I think the Republicans expected that they would have to turn them out in person, which they did in November. So that's what we're going to find out. We're going to find out who got the votes out, whether it was Donald Trump got the Republican votes out, or the Democrats who got their black voters out to get these guys over the top.
But when will we find that out? I mean, if Georgia officials have millions of early votes to count with signatures on ballot envelopes to verify, I mean, Kim, what do you suppose the chances are that we will know the results tomorrow or tonight, that we'll be able to talk about the winners on tomorrow's podcast?
Well, I will leave it to Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, and he said Tuesday morning, this morning, that it was not likely that the state's race would be called on election night. And that is, of course, because of the huge number of absentee ballots. He said that his office had been urging counties to do early scanning of absentee ballots so that they can work on the calculations tonight. But you're also going to have absentee ballots that are coming in during today, and those would also need to be scanned. So I would wager that we're more likely to hear an answer tomorrow morning. But it kind of depends. If it were a blowout one way or the other, maybe you'd find out something earlier. But again, every indication suggests that these are two very tight races. So I wouldn't necessarily stay up till 3 a.m. I'd just go to sleep and see the news in the a.m.
But the reason that both sides are so focused on these two runoffs, of course, is that they will decide who controls the Senate for the next 2 years. If Democrats win both of these races, you end up with a Senate that's split 50-50 with Vice President Kamala Harris as the tiebreaker. And so Joe Biden would go into the White House on January 20th with Democrats in full control of Washington, able to push through his agenda or at least more of his agenda. So, Bill, can you give people a sense of what the policy stakes are here?
Well, there's a lot. As you mentioned, this is a counter to Tip O'Neill's all politics are local. In Georgia, it's all national. It's for it will decide who controls the Senate. And the Senate as an institution is designed to temper and stop things. So if there's a Republican Senate, it leaves Mitch McConnell in a very good position to, if not block entirely — he can't stop everything that the Biden administration does, but he could really get them to moderate it and so forth, as long as he can hold his coalition together. On the other side, if the Democrats win and Kamala Harris proves a deciding vote, there's nothing to stop them. I think the most likely thing we'll see in the beginning are big spending bills, probably on health and so forth, and raising taxes. I mean, remember, Joe Biden promised to reverse the tax cuts of Donald Trump, so that would be an easy thing. There are more far-reaching things that I think would be in the realm of possibility, like packing the court, admitting new states, you know, largely Democratic, to the union, all sorts of things. I think, you know, it's carte blanche. And I think the Democrats in general, I think, as we saw with Obamacare, hold together better than the Republicans do. I mean, one of the things that would be interesting for me is if it's split in Georgia between a Republican and a Democrat, you know, you wonder where that puts Mitt Romney. Does he become another John McCain, you know, joining the other side for a vote? I mean, that's possible on both sides. But again, I think the Democrats do a better job of holding it. And each side knows that this is about the extent and reach of the Biden presidency. Is it really going to be about changing the country, as Senator Chuck Schumer said, if they win Georgia? Or is it just going to be, you know, the normal give and take of American politics, with the Republicans at least representing, you know, one house of Congress?
Well, let's break it down this way, I guess. There's some things that a Democratic Senate split 50-50 with Kamala Harris as a tiebreaker would do. And then there's other things like statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico that would probably depend on breaking the Senate filibuster. And let's talk about the first group first, I guess. A couple things that I would bring up is the Congressional Review Act first. That's a law that allows Congress, with a simple majority, to undo regulations that were passed in the previous 60 legislative days. And it looks like when the new Congress comes in, that reaches back to last August. And so anything that the Trump administration has done last August, including rules by, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission, by the Energy Department, by the EPA, all of that stuff can be rolled back. And those Congressional Review Act resolutions are not filibusterable. So that's something they can clearly do. Kim, another one is cabinet picks and judicial picks. If the Democrats hold the Senate versus if Republicans hold the Senate, I mean, that could affect a simple thing is who Joe Biden chooses, whether he picks somebody that he knows he has to get through an opposition Senate, or if he really swings for the fences on some of these nominees.
Yeah. What you're referencing here is the simple fact that control, again, even with 50 votes and Kamala Harris is a tiebreaker, means that control of every committee in the Senate goes over to what are now the ranking Democratic members. And that means not just what you were talking about in terms of cabinet picks and judicial picks, they would wave through everybody, but it also means that they have control of investigations. Republicans should care about that a lot, because with a Biden administration and a change in the Department of Justice, you're not going to be, I mean, yes, you're still going to have Durham's investigation into what's happening in what happened at the FBI, John Durham, as a special counsel. But the other real check has been, Senate committees doing their own work on some of that, or looking, for instance, at Hunter Biden's China dealings. So that changes. You also just have to imagine the policy and the ideas and hearings that would come out of those new committees. So you'd have Bernie Sanders, who would be at the budget committee. You'd have Sherrod Brown running the banking committee. You'd have Elizabeth Warren as the top person on the financial institutions subcommittee. And Ron Wyden running taxes at Finance Committee. And that's the other major thing that they could do, too. People forget that you only need 51 votes to pass budget resolutions. Those are the vehicles by which you can change tax rates. And so it would probably mean an instant bye-bye to most of the Trump tax cuts of a couple years ago, but they'd probably even go much farther. Their spending plans are so extraordinary. I think you'd see all kinds of new tax increases, creative ones, designed to underwrite their agenda.
I'd add to Kim, one of the things that strikes me would be an obvious difference would be aid to the states, especially to blue Democratic states like California, Illinois, maybe even New Jersey, which Senator McConnell has largely resisted in the COVID relief bills. I think if the Republicans lose the Senate, I think that goes right out the window. And I expect some bailouts again for California and Illinois.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kind of heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. The other category include things like Joe Biden's public option, a Green New Deal, statehood for the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, and that would depend on breaking the Senate filibuster. And Kim, do you think that's likely if there's a Senate with 50 Democratic votes and a tiebreaker as Kamala Harris, or do you think there are some Democratic moderates like Joe Manchin who would say no to that?
Well, it's funny to me because if you talk to business people and different activist groups out there, they seem to have discounted this, and largely because West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin came out prior to the election saying that he would not be the final vote to kill the legislative filibuster. I think my problem with that is that the pressure on him to change that position would be enormous. I mean, overwhelming. And in the end, if you really look at Manchin's record, he's always been a very loyal party man when it really matters. So I wouldn't be remotely surprised to see him come up with the argument that he's thought about it some, and the Republicans are simply being so obstructionist that there's no other way to move forward, and that would just change things so extraordinarily. It's not just statehood for the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. You know, it's Biden's union agenda. You know, this is a Biden presidency that said he wants to get rid of the right to work in every state that has it. You could do that if you got rid of the legislative filibuster. All the changes Democrats want to make in terms of elections, ballot harvesting, and mail-in voting. And this is in addition to what you've talked about, Green New Deal, maybe a carbon tax, the public option for healthcare. So it would be an absolute game changer. And if you look at what the House Democrats did just this week with their new rules package, getting rid of a longstanding tradition of allowing motions to recommit, allowing the minority party to have the last vote on any piece of legislation to kind of force debates. They're happy to get rid of these procedural tools if it will consolidate their control. So, yeah, I think it's a real possibility.
Well, that sort of goes to my next question, which is, Bill, I mean, what about the idea that Nancy Pelosi's narrow majority in the House would act as a little bit of a break on the Democratic agenda here? I mean, they only control the House with a 10-seat majority. And, you know, there's some House moderates, too, there that are watching their 2022 election bids.
Well, again, it depends on how she reads it and what she ranks as important. Remember, it was very tight with Obamacare, and she rammed that through. Very controversial, I think, with one Republican vote, the guy from Louisiana. So, you know, she's done it before. Also, I think there's another factor in this that's different from before. The pressure is all going to come from the left, the Bernie Sanders, the AOCs. They already think the Biden administration is being staffed with too many moderates. So the pressure and the push, I think, for them to use their majority when they have it will be tremendous. As Kim says, like with Mr. Manchin, you know, his record is he'll sometimes vote with the Republicans against some big Democratic favored bill, but he generally, I can't think of an example where he's been the deciding vote, because there's really a price in the Democratic Party for being that. So I'm not so sure how many are really going to resist their leaders.
So those are the policy stakes, the political stakes for the Senate for these runoffs. But what's probably on a lot of people's minds also is the Trump factor, the president's efforts to throw a wrench in the counting of the Electoral College votes tomorrow, and his continuing push to overturn the election results in Georgia. The big news there was that on Saturday, President Trump had a call with Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. And audio of that call has now been posted. Anybody can go listen to it online. Trump lost the state, according to the certified election results, by 11,779 votes. And what he tells Raffensperger is, quote, I just want to find 11,780 votes. And he also says this. He says, quote, the people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated. Unquote. Kim, what did you make of that call?
Well, you know, those were the quotes that everybody's highlighting in the press, and they certainly have a bad sound to them. If you read the entire transcript of the call, it was set up in part, it was originally or seemed to be set up to allow some of the attorneys representing Trump and some of these suits to ask questions of some of these Georgia officials and try to get some answers. And one of the resolutions at the end of the call was that there were going to be some meetings between them, but the complaint among the Trump team is that they feel that they haven't had access to data that backs up Raffensperger's claims that there was no fraud, and they want more disclosure. Now, there are some questions about legally whether or not the Secretary of State is even allowed to provide that information to anybody. That was the idea. It, as often happens, the call ended up being dominated by Donald Trump. He spends a lot of his time expressing his frustration about what he claims are episodes of fraud. The Secretary of State's office made the argument that he was simply wrong in many cases. And all of that overshadowed the kind of attorney's things, and obviously vastly was overshadowed by that one comment from Trump, but where it made it sound as though his only interest was finding enough votes to win. I think, in fact, that the call was more broadly about these claims of fraud, even though they still have not produced evidence of them in court of law.
And just to dig into that a little bit more, a lot of the focus appeared to be on this matching between Georgia's voter files and other data sets. So, for example, in one lawsuit that the Trump campaign filed, the campaign claimed that there were 10,000 dead people that voted in Georgia, and that's based on comparing names and birth years from voter records against death records. But that's not an exact match, because names and birth years, I mean, how many John Smiths are there that were born in 1968? There are 11 million people in Georgia, and Georgia officials who have more precise information on these people are saying that that's not accurate, that they have looked at that and they've identified maybe two people who died after they submitted a ballot. And so some of the call was the Trump campaign people saying, well, we haven't seen that data. Can you give us access to that data? And the Georgia officials saying, you know, this is private information. We don't think under law that we can release that. But Bill, the idea that there were 10,000 dead people who voted in Georgia and that Georgia's Republican elected officials are covering this up, it seems very, very unlikely to me.
Yeah, well, to me, the whole thing seems unlikely, but I don't think it's going to go away. The president clearly is going to litigate this, probably even past the time that he leaves the White House. And, you know, some people will never believe that it was fair. Some people will be on the other side. So, you know, I think in many ways it was more of the same, except for the leak of the phone call. I mean, taping a president and leaking it, that seems to me a very extraordinary thing. Then again, we've had a lot of extraordinary things, including Donald Trump's behavior in this administration. To me, it's just more of the same. There are a lot of questions. I read the transcript and I couldn't follow all of the president's claims. I mean, I believe he was claiming that he won Georgia by at least 400,000 votes. And again, I just think that he's come up short in terms of the evidence.
Well, what about that question on taping and then releasing the tape of the president? The Secretary of State Raffensperger defended himself in local media, and his argument is essentially that that Trump was tweeting incorrect things about the meeting. Here's what Trump tweeted. He said, I spoke to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger yesterday about Fulton County and voter fraud in Georgia. He was unwilling or unable to answer questions such as ballots under the table scam, ballot destruction, out-of-state voters. He has no clue. And so what Brad Raffensperger, Kim, is telling local media is that there was no agreement this call would be confidential. Here's what he said. He said, quote, it was a private conversation. As far as I was concerned, he broke privacy when he put out a tweet, and his tweet was false.
Yeah, I mean, look, I still think it's somewhat indefensible. Most people assume when they are talking to the president of the United States that it is a confidential call. So to just say, well, you know, there was no expectation of privacy is kind of silly. You can make a different argument. Well, if he talked about it, then I'm allowed to talk about it too. But I think the bigger point here is that I can't believe that anyone on the Trump team didn't think this was going to be leaked. I mean, just because of the history of this presidency and the way it has routinely been treated and not afforded the sort of privacy that other presidents have. It's just been besieged by leaks all the time. So maybe they weren't surprised to see it actually come from the Georgia Secretary of State side. But, you know, we've long had a history of people listening in on these things or transcribers putting them out. So that to me should have argued against maybe having a more discreet call again between the Trump campaign attorneys and people within the Secretary of State's office, rather than one in which the president was the central figure, which almost guaranteed that this was going to become public.
Yeah, I'd like to just add one point. He may have told local media that, but Mr. Raffensperger was on Martha McCallum, and he didn't really defend himself very well on the leak. He said he didn't tape the call, but he was part of the decision to leak it. And he made it sound as though he were getting back at David Perdue in a way. It was not a good look. It was not a persuasive answer when he did that. I mean, now it's done. And people have to deal with it. And as Kim says, you know, sooner or later, this was probably going to come out.
Another reaction on the left is there's been suggestions that this call by Trump could be potentially prosecuted. So Eric Holder, former attorney general, on Monday tweeted, as you listen to the tape, consider this federal criminal statute. And then he links to a law that says you can be fined or imprisoned not more than 5 years for knowingly and willfully depriving, defrauding, or attempting to deprive the residents of a state of a fair and impartially conducted election process. Kim, what do you think of that suggestion?
Well, you know, one of the problems with the left arguing that anything that any Republican does, and in particular Donald Trump does, is always worthy of being thrown in jail for, is that after a while, nobody pays attention to you after a while. And, you know, that's that falls into this category for me. We have spent 4 years with Democrats claiming that every time Donald Trump opens his mouth, he's committed a high crime or a misdemeanor. I think you can read that transcript and you can make the argument that he was, you know, in very Trumpian style, pushing his argument for why there was fraud and arguing that the election didn't happen freely and fairly himself. You don't have to believe it. You don't have to agree with it. You can make the argument he hasn't presented the evidence. But to assume that his motive was to somehow break the law and illegally himself steal the election, I think you'd have a harder time arguing that in a court of law.
And I mean, I guess I agree with that. I mean, on the transcript, if you listen to the call, Trump seems convinced by his argument. He says, "I won this election by hundreds of thousands of votes. There's no way I lost Georgia. There's no way." And that might be way off base. I personally think it is way off base. But Bill, that seems to cut against the argument that he was knowingly and willfully, as Kim says, trying to steal Georgia.
Yeah, I think this is a crazy interpretation that it's criminal. Alan Dershowitz has come out saying it's not criminal. I think you'd have to improve some kind of intent. And again, he was talking about 400,000 votes. He's basically saying there's so many votes for me out there. Can't you find 12,000 that would put me over the top? You know, it's a storm. I think, you know, Donald Trump invites by, you know, by he's a disruptor and stormy behavior too. But I don't think anyone really looks good in this.
All right. Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.